Utah's home to a number of conventions. There's Salt Lake FanX for the geeks, USANA for the supplement takers, and if you happen to get a good whiff of the air while you're visiting Salt Lake in September, you know when the doTERRA convention is in town. But it might be surprising that in this staunchly conservative red state, Utah's first ever cannabis convention filled the halls of the Mountain America Expo Center in Sandy, just weeks before voters decide whether or not medical cannabis should be legalized. Some of the attendees appeared to be right at home among the CBD oils and green leaf decor. Others didn't start out as fans of the plant.
No, actually, I used to be against it. I actually dumped a whole pound of cannabis down the drain. I used to be completely against this. I got sick with chronic pancreatitis about 6-7 years ago. Started using cannabis more in regards to helping me because they had me on opiates, 19 medications a day. And so I turned to cannabis, and now I am on no medications, and I am on cannabis, and I am healthy and happy and back to my life again.
This is In the Hive. I'm Emily Means. Polling on legalizing medical cannabis through Proposition 2 has been consistently high among Utah voters, with support in the 60s up until recent weeks, when it dropped to just above 50%. 30 states have legalized medical cannabis, and 9 states have legalized cannabis for recreational use. But, like that person at the convention, public opinion of cannabis hasn't always been so favorable. I asked Matthew Burbank, a political scientist at the University of Utah, if the reefer madness days of the past were over, or does that sentiment still linger?
Well, there's at least a small element of that still out there. And we've seen a little bit of that here in Utah with the kind of reaction, particularly of the law enforcement community, which in a way has framed this largely in terms of saying, if we have legal marijuana or medical marijuana, right, that's going to lead to recreational. It's just a slippery slope, which again is not necessarily the case. Those are treated differently as political issues, but that's been some of the language that has been used, you know, among opponents to this, and so we've seen a little bit of that. But again, one of the major things that we have seen over the course of probably the last 15 years or so is a large change in public opinion with regard to this issue. Initially, when we looked at this issue, it really was largely a law and order issue. And this was something that was illegal. The federal government said it was illegal. Virtually all states said it was illegal, with the exception of some cities which had kind of decriminalized it. By and large, people said, no, this is a drug. It's a bad thing. And, you know, we wouldn't even contemplate making changes. But one of the things that we've seen that has been quite striking is changes in people's attitudes about the use of marijuana for medical purposes, and also, as you indicated, in a number of states, allowing it for recreational use as well.
So how does that change happen? Is it just as we receive more information, we can make more educated opinions about this, or is it that it's more popular to use it and it's more accessible? Or do you have any insight on that?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, about the nature of public opinion, one of the things that is generally true about public opinion with respect to a whole number of political issues is at the individual level, public opinion is quite changeable. People can change their opinions quite easily. At the aggregate level, it changes much more slowly. And indeed, oftentimes, aggregate public opinion looks quite stable and incremental, whereas at the individual level, people often will change their opinions based upon, you know, something somebody said or a story they read or, mm-hmm. you know, any of a variety of other things. I mean, one of the things that is true about marijuana, however, is that as a political issue, is that it's not something that for most people takes a huge amount of information. That is, they don't need to go research it. They don't need to, you know, it's not something that's a technical difficult issue to figure out, such as entitlement funding or something like that. This is something where most people, their reaction comes from their own experiences, the experiences of other people that they knew. And one of the things I think that was really striking to me about kind of the early public opinion in Utah is you mentioned these polls, and again, 60-65% support for medical marijuana. And again, the fact that the initiative got on the ballot, it's a high bar. It's not an easy thing to do. So that's something which really indicated this was not just a small group of people who were pushing this. There was actually fairly broad support. And I think one of the reasons for that is because there has been a lot of word of mouth among people who have said, oh, I know somebody who this worked for. I know somebody whose child is sick and they have used this and it helped. And those kinds of stories are very powerful in terms of having an impact on people because they think, yes, this could happen to me. It could happen to somebody that I know and I perhaps would want this option. And so there's a sense that that's really, I think a lot of those kinds of stories have been what has changed people's mind.
Well, I wonder if people were surprised at how much support it's had in Utah, because a largely Republican state, and this week Gallup released some polling results, and 53% of Republicans are in favor of legalizing marijuana. Do we think of cannabis as a Republican issue or more of a Democratic issue? And maybe you can give some reasons why both sides would be interested in this.
So one of the things that has been true for a long time is that the public opinion on questions such as decriminalizing or legalizing marijuana have been pretty predictable. That is that conservatives, Republicans, older people tended to be against it, and the people who tended to be for it tended to be liberals, Democrats, and younger people, just as you would sort of imagine that would work out. And the differences weren't huge there because, again, most people for most of this period kind of generally were opposed to it, but there were those clear differences on those kinds of factors. One of the things that's happened, however, is we've seen this more broadly with the questions about sentencing, for example. Our own Senator Mike Lee has been one of the people who has been saying we may need to rethink our approach, for example, to the war on drugs, our approach to mandatory sentences. And what we've seen on the Republican side, and I suspect that this is connected, is that there have been a number of Republicans who have said simply locking people up may not be the best way, and certainly it's not the most cost-effective way. There are some people, Senator Rand Paul is an example of this, who essentially make the argument that, you know, this is a waste of money. We shouldn't be doing
it's
this.
It's expensive to keep people in prison.
Exactly right. We shouldn't do it at the federal level. We shouldn't do it at the state level as well. And there are others, and again, Senator Lee is one of those who's thinking about this in slightly broader terms and simply saying, what we need to be aware of is the fact that this may not work the way that we intend. It may not have the deterrent effect. And again, it's costing a lot of money. And it's horribly disruptive, particularly if you're talking about people who are being put in jail for possession of a small amount of marijuana. That's something that, again, a lot of Republicans even, I think, are looking at that saying, I'm not sure I can support that anymore.
So there's that fiscal conservatism element. I would also imagine maybe the argument that limited government is appropriate in this sort of situation. Are you getting any sense of that?
Well, certainly, again, Rand Paul's a good example of this, right? It's very much a libertarian argument,
yeah.
Right? That we should just keep government out of this. Government doesn't need to regulate this. This is not something that we need government intervention for. Again, for many more establishment Republicans, and I use that term sort of loosely, that there's a recognition that they might not buy the full libertarian argument because, of course, a constant theme for the Republicans and certainly for our current president has been talking about law and order. And that's something that resonates with a lot of Americans, certainly. And so there's a sense that they're not quite willing to change their minds too quickly on that. But again, it's something where I think on this particular issue for a lot of Americans, they look at this and they say, well, I'm not sure that marijuana is the same thing as heroin or opioids. And that's one of the things I think also that's changed people's mind is the sense that, the kind of the biggest problem we have with addiction in the United States at the moment really comes from prescription medicines and not necessarily from something like marijuana. And so I think there's also, again, kind of been a rethinking of this about what information do we have and what does this mean? And again, I think there's a general sense that that has helped people kind of reframe the nature of that issue.
That was Matthew Burbank, political scientist at the University of Utah. Both Proposition 2 and the draft of the legislative compromise bill list particular illnesses and conditions that would qualify for a medical cannabis card, including epilepsy, HIV, and cancer. Laura, an artist in Salt Lake City, has one such illness, ulcerative colitis. You'll remember that Matthew Burbank mentioned that individuals often form opinions based on an anecdote they heard or an article they read. Here, Laura shares her own experience, which she says has shaped the perspectives of her friends and family.
It started in 2009. I think that I had an episode, like the Christmas before. It was stressful, and as soon as the stress was over, it went away. But when I left this relationship, it was a very quick and immediate decision. The very next day, the symptoms started, and it was like diarrhea with intense pain and rapid weight loss. But I let the illness just go on because the stresses were going on. So I thought it was, you know, when I'm not stressed out anymore, this is going to stop. Well, a year and a half went by, and my mom was like, oh my gosh, what is wrong with you? You're going to the doctor. And that's when I found out that I had the UC. Basically, what that is my whole large intestine, you know, your large intestine is like 6 to 8 feet long, and it could be 1 foot of it, top or bottom, or in the center, or whatever, that is affected. But for me, it was the whole thing. By the time I went to the doctor, the whole thing was just full of ulcers, and now I'm living with diarrhea basically every day. There's no warning. There's, like, no control. It is an emergency. You're like 30 seconds, oh my gosh, I need to get to the restroom, which starts to make you live in terror. So you start not doing anything.
Mm-hmm. Because you don't know if there's going to be a bathroom ready for you.
Right. No, you don't even want to get in the car and go anywhere. I have had to learn how to work around situations like that. I have had some really embarrassing situations, really humiliating.
When you went to the doctor, what did they prescribe to you?
I cannot remember what the first drug was, but I remember him telling me that it was the cheapest since I didn't have insurance. This drug was not working at all, so we went up to the next step. But this drug also was not working. They would supplement it with prednisone when I would be in a big flare, but I was always in a flare. So I ended up being on prednisone for 7 years. Mm-hmm. And it's an emergency drug. You're only supposed to use it like a week, a month maybe.
And you were on it for 7 years.
For 7 years.
So how did that affect you?
They ended up putting me on 3 other drugs for what I believed were the side effects of the prednisone. So Prozac for antidepressant, mm-hmm. and then Xanax. I got to a point where I couldn't control my emotions anymore. Then we also tried Klonopin at one time just for the emotional stuff. And eventually I started having like suicidal thoughts every day being on all these drugs. If you miss them, if you don't do them consistently, it just throws you out of balance so quick.
So you're kind of dependent on these different right. Emotional regulating drugs.
Yeah, you would just miss your prescription for 2 days, and it is really scary. You start thinking about killing yourself, and you know you don't want to.
How long were you on this treatment plan?
Intermittently, we tried other things like Humira, azathioprine. These drugs were even worse, the side effects. I would stand up from a chair and every single one of my joints would just light on fire. I was gaining weight and losing weight, which again, like emotionally, is
stressful.
Affecting you.
Yeah.
And when I would realize that the things wouldn't work, so azathioprine, my hair was falling out, my fingernails were just like snapping off. I was trying to get myself off of the prednisone. Every time I've tried to wean myself off the prednisone, I've ended up in the emergency room. At one of these times when I was trying to get myself off of the prednisone, I ended up getting so sick that I had to call out of work for 3 weeks. And the first week wasn't that bad, but it was so bad that I had to have a friend come and pick my dogs. I couldn't take them outside. I couldn't, like, even feed them. Another week went by, and everybody's calling me, finding out, are you okay? What's going on? Because mm-hmm. they're rescheduling my appointments. And the third week, that same friend who picked up my dogs came and got me and took me to the emergency room. I think I had not eaten any food in, like, 5 or 6 days.
Oh, wow.
And it's just a constant laying in bed and running to the bathroom, laying in bed, running to the bathroom. My everyday life like that, when I would be sleeping, I would need to, like, just everyday illness, I would have to get up 5 to 10 times during the night to go use the restroom. If I was really sick, I might get up every time I just moved a little bit. So maybe 20, 25 times a night. So you're getting no sleep. Mm-hmm. And then throughout the day also, every half an hour, every hour. Obviously, it's not a lot, but it is an emergency.
You know, you mentioned earlier that the stress was really a trigger for this. So it seems like, you know, it's just a vicious circle of stressing you out, having to go to the bathroom, and having to go to the bathroom stressing you out, and over and over and over again.
So when she took me to the emergency room, I told them that I have UC and that I, you know, that I was addicted to prednisone, but I was trying to get myself off of it, and that I have been in this 3-week stupor. They gave me prednisone as a rescue drug, which is what it's for. I couldn't get in to see my specialist for 30 days. So I had a doctor at the time. She's not a doctor. She's a physician's assistant. But she just prescribes drugs like willy-nilly. So I go to see her, and she just bumps me right up to 60 milligrams prednisone. But she was like, no, it sounds like you're almost dying. I am going to do whatever I have to do to get you out of this situation that you're in. So by the time I get to see the GI doctor in a month, he's like, 60 milligrams. Okay, well, you've already been doing that for a month. So all we can do is like start weaning you back off of it. It took me a year to get back down to the 5 milligrams.
So when you went to your GI, you were on all these other prescriptions. What did you ask from them?
I had always been terrified of having to have this surgery where I could end up with a colostomy bag. After this illness, I was just like so desperate that I told him, I want the surgery. I don't ever want to be this sick again. I couldn't go on living my life in fear and in pain. He told me, well, you're not going to get the surgery until you have cancer. And that's probably around year 8. Well, I'm in year 9 now. What I typically feel like on a daily basis is like what most women feel like when they're on their menstrual cycle. Bloated, cramping. I just feel queasy and sick. Mm-hmm. But that's every day.
Yeah.
So when you feel that every day, you start blocking those things out. So then you really only feel bad when you're like having a knife stabbed into your guts. And
you become immune to it, and it's just a part of your regular life. So after, you know, the doctor said that you wouldn't be having this surgery that you were hoping to have, what did you do?
I just started working towards getting off the drugs. That was my only thought. I also go to see my family, who all lives in Denver, for Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. So when I was sick, those 3 weeks when I was first sick, it was the beginning of November. And right after this, I went to go see my family. So when I was visiting my family, I was still very ill. We were doing family things. We were out at a restaurant, and I didn't even order food. I knew that I wasn't going to be able to eat, but I would like to eat. Like, I probably haven't eaten very much in a few days. And I was just sitting there so miserable and in pain and just like suffering through this family thing that should be fun. Mm-hmm. And my sister's boyfriend was like, hey, come to the car. And we smoked in the car. And by the time I sat back at the table, I'm like feeling so good. Like, not so good like I do now, but in the moment, I'm like picking off of people's plates. I feel like I can eat. I don't feel like as soon as I put food in my mouth, I'm going to be running for the bathroom. You know, I'm just able to relax a little bit, eat this food without it killing me, mm-hmm. and live my life, you know? Mm-hmm. So that was in Denver. And then I'm coming back home. So, you know, then I'm going through, you know, months of not trying that out. There's this place that my sister's boyfriend goes to, a dispensary, mm-hmm. you know, and all the dispensaries have their different little brands and things that they sell.
Different products.
So this product that I got this time, was a powder, and you like mix it into water or orange juice or something. And it was a THC and CBD 50-50. Mm-hmm. And I sat there. I have never, not on the Xanax, not on anything, never felt so good. Like, I had no pain, no stress. It was the first time ever that I sat there and I wasn't worrying about running to the bathroom. Everything was just calm. Like, I didn't feel any pain, and I didn't feel any urgency, and I didn't feel any stress.
One of the concerns with medical marijuana is that there's not necessarily consensus on the dosing for this. How have you figured out what works for you? Was there a lot of trial and error, and were you trying a lot of CBD products and kind of comparing everything?
I was not trying a lot of CBD products. Okay. I have tried some CBD products, but not consistently. With the, like, smoking, I mean, honestly, you just do what you feel comfortable with. Like, if you feel too weird, like, don't do that and go anywhere, you know?
Be safe about it. Be responsible about it.
Be responsible. You have to know your limits. You have to do what you feel is comfortable.
So have you been able to wean yourself off of every prescription?
I have been off of all prescription drugs for a year and a half.
Do you think that if your doctor would have had this kind of relationship with you and had presented medical marijuana as an option to you, that would have really worked for you to have someone walking you through this whole process?
I think so. I think even them being open-minded, the physician's assistant that I had gone to see, I tried to speak to her just about doing like an organic vegan diet, and she laughed in my face. That was the last time I went to see her. So, yes, their attitude definitely plays a huge role in how you feel about their treatment. And if they were to even consider other options than just selling pharmaceutical drugs, I think people would believe them more. If they recommended, you know, diet and exercise and natural remedies, like, that's what a doctor should be, not a representative for the pharmaceutical industry. Well, I'm sorry that I feel that way, but now I feel that way.
Well, you know, we know that there's a societal stigma around marijuana use. Have you felt any pressure from your family or your friends or your social circles or law enforcement to not be using marijuana as treatment?
Everyone that I work with, everyone that I know who has seen me go through this 9 years of misery and transition are absolutely for it. I think I have everyone registered to vote. They are all like voting for Prop 2, whether they are smokers or not, just because they see it affecting somebody's life in a positive way.
Laura, thanks so much for sharing your very personal story, and congratulations on having your quality of life improved. I mean, just to be able to walk around and actually enjoy life must be so meaningful.
No, I am the happiest that I have been in 9 years, and I feel the best that I have felt in more than 3 years. I'm definitely a huge proponent, and I'm not trying to get everybody to smoke weed. I'm just trying to say that it's an option.
Like public and personal opinions, cultural norms and social contexts can also adjust over time. Andy Golub is a senior principal investigator at the National Development and Research Institutes. His research includes an analysis of the U.S. war on drugs with an eye towards creating policy through a social lens. In Utah, some of the opposition to the medical cannabis initiative stems from the fear that legalization in this capacity will lead to legalization of recreational marijuana, a sort of think-of-the-children mindset where cannabis is a gateway drug to other substances. As cannabis becomes legalized in states across the nation, and likely at the federal level, Golub has some suggestions for smoothly transitioning into new policy in a way that addresses everyone's concerns, whether they want to participate in the use of the drug or not.
I think it's important to maintain honesty, and there have been overblown claims about marijuana and misinformation floating around, and it undercuts one's credibility if they stand on claims that are inappropriate or that are technically incorrect. And then the other aspect that I feel very strongly about and why different cultures need to transition slowly and be sure to maintain respect for plurality of cultures is that it's dangerous to simply get involved with different substances. One needs to learn how to appropriately integrate their substance use into an otherwise healthy and functional, socially positive lifestyle. So this is why we talk about a revolution and the evolution of society. It's not a revolution in a prescriptive sense that we need to stand up in any manner. It's more in response to the idea of a industrial revolution that came through the United States in the 19th century. We're similarly having another technological revolution involving drugs this time. And it's important for us to plot our course and to think about and be in touch with our values and build policies and programs honestly that will work with the plurality of cultures in our society.
Has your opinion of cannabis changed over time? Weigh in at KCPW's Facebook page, KCPW 88.3, or email us at comments@kcpw.org with your feedback and questions. Special thanks to In the Hive production assistant Sarah Sadikon and the rest of the KCPW team for their support of this show, as well as to Andrew Shaw, who produced the show's theme music. And thank you for tuning in. You can find podcasts of In the Hive at kcpw.org. Up next is Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Emily Neans. Thanks for listening.